What is television doing to your mind? I remember sitting in front of the television many hours. I was raised, of course, on the tail end of the baby boom generation with television as my constant companion, my confidant, my best friend in many ways. So typical of us boomers. I remember sitting on the floor watching hours and hours of television. And in those days, it was downright wholesome compared to what you have today. I mean, the Three Stooges was about as racy as it got for kids like us. And I remember my mom saying to us kids, it's going to rot your brain. It just is. First, it's going to make you blind because you're just staring into this radioactivity all day long, and then it's going to rot your brain. And as a kid, I guess I didn't mind the idea of having my brain rotted. It was the going blind because that meant I couldn't watch any more television. What is television doing to our minds? Not just the sex and the violence and the leftist agenda, but the medium itself. What is it robbing us of? We're going to talk about that in the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. We're coming to you live Monday. It's December the 1st. Douglas Grotheis of Denver Seminary will be our guest for this first topic in the first half hour. I hope you had a nice Thanksgiving weekend. I certainly did. In the second half hour of the program, Robert Knight joins us from he's the director of the Culture and Family Institute that is affiliated with Concerned Women for America. He joins us from Washington, D.C. to talk about World AIDS Day, that's today, and the gay marriage issue. In the second hour of the program, open lines. Now, I said I had a good Thanksgiving day. Been eating like a pig for the last 4 days is what I've been doing, and it got me to thinking, especially after I came across an article at beliefnet.com on gluttony. I wonder to myself, am I a glutton eating like a pig for 4 straight days? Now, see, I justify it by saying I need to get rid of the leftovers. It would be wasteful for me not to gorge myself on turkey and stuffing, potatoes, and all manner of casseroles because it would be wasteful. But Scripture is very clear that one of the vices, one of the sins that is condemned is gluttony. We'll talk about gluttony during open lines. Are you a glutton? Is it still a sin? What about diets like the Atkins diet that encourage you to eat anything you want as long as it doesn't have carbohydrates in it? Anything you want, as much as you want, and still stay thin. Can you be a glutton and be thin? Then I'd like to talk about an issue raised on the gay marriage issue by three columns I read today. First by Cal Thomas. He says that gay marriage should be the moral issue of the 2004 presidential campaign. I wonder, what do you expect of the candidates, of President George W. Bush and his opponents on this issue? Do you expect them to make it an issue or to continue to dance around it like they have been going into the presidential campaign? Those questions for open lines. In the third part of Issues Etc. today, the final half hour from 5 to 5:30, Pastor David Peterson joins us. Yesterday began the season of Advent, the first season of the church year. We'll talk about this season with him in the last half hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Doug Grotheis is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's director of philosophy of religion program at Denver Seminary. He's author of several books, including his latest, On Pascal and On Jesus. He's also written an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled The Media Fast, Renewing Your Mind in a Worldly World. Doug, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
What is the worst effect that television, as kind of the portal to the whole world of media, what is the worst effect that it has on us?
The worst effect is it tends to make us worldly in one way or the other. And I was arrested by a comment years ago by a Christian author, Larry Wawoody, who wrote an essay in Primus called Television, the Cyclops That Eats Books. And I sort of amplified on that a little bit in my article. Television, even if it's quote-unquote good television, that is, the content is wholesome, nothing anti-Christian, nothing radically false or deceptive, really does not engage the mind the way that a good conversation or reading a book will stimulate and engage your mind, because it's, of course, dominated by images. Words are quite secondary to television in many cases. In fact, talking heads are considered bad television. So you have to always spice things up, hence the increase in special effects and so on. So if people become habituated to television, as sadly most Americans are, they become conditioned by it, and in becoming conditioned by it, they tend to view reality through television. So everything has to conform to television. So sometimes we speak to each other more in sound bites than in full, complete, or rich sentences. Or we think that if we have seen an image of something on television, then we have the truth, which may not be the case at all. So I'm worried about television as you put it earlier, rotting the mind. And anything that rots the mind cannot be Christ-honoring, since Christ called us to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, strength, and mind. And Paul calls us to take every thought captive to obey Christ. And I'm worried that a lot of our thinking has been taken captive by the sensibilities and worldviews of television.
You use the term worldly. One of the worst effects that it has on us is that it makes us worldly. Let's define that term, if we could. Flesh it out for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, being worldly means not putting Christ first, making secondary things primary, or, worse yet, making sinful things primary. So being worldly means not to be Christ-centered. That's the most general kind of sense that I can give it. So in our culture, one of the principal indications of worldliness would be anti-intellectualism, that we don't think through the things that matter most. We just react, and typically we react images or slogans or factoids. And another one would be our consumerist, materialist, instant gratification mentality, where we want everything to be simple, we want it our way, and we want it now. And of course, a godly character requires patience. One of the fruit of the Spirit is patience. Our culture is a culture of impatience, and I think television is a leading engine of that kind of impatience.
Doug, you turn on the typical Christian media, be it television or radio, geared toward the Christian audience, and what I see, or I guess more properly put, what I fail to see is critical thinking. What I do see is a mishmash, kind of a patchwork of contradictory ideas, very often asserted, seldom supported, especially in terms of theology. Just this patchwork of mutually exclusive ideas that are all kind of held in suspended in midair. And no one seems to question whether or not they are true. They just kind of hold them together. And this is what passes for the Christian voice in the media.
Well, sadly, that's the case. Now, sometimes you will find Christian statesmen who appear on television, such as John Montgomery, who do a very good job, but sadly, they're the minority. And television really does not lend itself to a coherent, consistent discourse. So you might have a wise woman or man on Christian television trying to articulate a viewpoint, then they may be interrupted by someone who has very little wisdom, and then you cut to the pledge drive or to the commercial, and any momentum of thought has been completely derailed. So what I advise my students is, in developing a Christian mind, and that is an imperative for all believers, don't rely on television, even Christian television. In fact, one of the points of my article was for people to go on a media fast, that is to completely abstain from television for 1 week and see what happens to your life. And I found that most of the students that I have imposed this on as the imperious professor over the years have benefited from it, and they report some very significant things, like they feel less distracted, less harried, more calm. They have more time for reflection, more time for prayer, conversation, recreation, and so on. So I would challenge your listeners, if they do watch very much television, and the average, from what I read, is about 4 hours a day, and Barna says we're really no different from the rest of the culture on those kinds of things. Just give it up. Cold turkey. 1 week. See what happens. See if the Lord begins to work on you in some new and edifying ways.
Now, you call for the media fast. What do you suggest takes the place of the 4 average hours that we spend sitting in front of the television?
Preferably not another vice. That is, I wouldn't want people to give up television and then play video games for 4 hours or something like that. So what happens is people simply find themselves with more quiet, less agitation, and some downtime. So you have to get creative. And there are plenty of things to do in this world. God's given us many opportunities to do good and to recreate. So students just naturally find time to maybe catch up on their sleep. A lot of Americans are not adequately rested. You might take a nap. It's a creative thing to do. You might spend some more time speaking with your family members. One of my students did this years ago as a pastor, and he said he turned off the television in his room, and when he did so, he could hear what was going on in the other rooms of the house, and he could hear what his other family members were doing. So that gave him more connection. He was not sonically isolated from the rest of the family as he was before. So more time to read. I'm a great advocate of reading. I think it's a lost art. It's a tremendously enriching, rewarding, but also demanding activity. You can probably spend more time reading and reflecting on books, not just the bestsellers, but the scripture and Christian classics. There's plenty of things to do. But at first, my students tell me that there's a bit of a withdrawal. Because what you're used to doing, let's say watching television during dinner or watching television before you go to bed, is no longer there. So there's a change of routine, a change of ambiance. So you have to be a little creative in those moments.
I imagine the withdrawal also comes from the fact that, as I said early in our conversation, television does have a tendency to become companion, confidant, best friend.
Right. Well, people become habituated to it, or at worst, addicted to it. For instance, many of my students tell me when they do this fast that they notice that they instinctively reach for the television when they enter a room. So you have to stop that. You have to sort of slap your hand and say, stop that. We're not going to engage in that today. So you have to break some patterns, and then you have to seek out some richer, deeper, really, I think, more satisfying means of involvement. Because interestingly, very many studies have shown that the typical feeling that people get from watching television is a mild sense of depression and a sense of being tired but having done nothing. Why is it then that we keep watching? It's rather odd. I think it's because of the nature of the medium itself. You have the light coming through a medium, sort of like a stained glass window. It's moving. You have to put the dots together yourself in your mind. And that tends to attract attention. Now, I really hate television, and I never watch it, frankly, except for rare situations where there's an emergency, like 9/11, and you can get the fastest factoids on television. But after that, I stop watching. But if I'm in a room when television is on, I notice my eyes naturally go towards it, even though I dislike it intensely. So there's something strange going on. It might even be something nefarious on the spiritual side. So I think it's good to just turn it off, and then don't favor it either. Most living rooms are set up with the television essentially as the shrine. All the chairs are pointed towards it. The whole living room or family room or both is set up with the attention towards the television. One thing to do is to displace it, put it off to the side, or put it in a closet. and take it out only at selected times. Basically, discipline it. Don't let it rule you. You rule it.
I remember in the old days, the television stands were on wheels. Mm-hmm. It could be rolled off to the side because it wasn't a major feature of family life.
Right.
Now, at least in our home, we've got the so-called entertainment center. It looks like an armoire, but open it up, and it's pretty much just the place where the television lives. Mm-hmm. You got the best seat in the house, in fact.
Right. Well, it becomes literally a fixture. And it becomes a fixture with respect to furniture, and it becomes a kind of fixture in people's lives. And that's what I'm challenging. I think it should not be a fixture.
So if all the furniture is pointed toward the television, what does that do to family conversation and interaction?
Mm-hmm. Well, if the television is on, it destroys it. It's very difficult to have any kind of significant conversation while the television is on, even if you're talking about the television program, because the program just keeps moving. Now, if you're watching a video, that might allow you to stop and reflect and discuss things, so you can have a little more intellectual engagement there. But moreover, if everything is pointed towards the television and the television is off and people are sitting around talking, the couches and chairs and so on may not even be set up so that people can be very easily looking at each other. So that's kind of an interesting arrangement when you think about it.
Dr. Doug Grotheis is our guest. We're talking about media and the Christian mind during this half hour of Issues, Etc. If you'd like to join us, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The two effects that you listed before, Dr. Grotheis, being anti-intellectualism and the consumer mentality, what does this anti-intellectualism look like, especially when it manifests itself among Christians?
It has a lot of features. One is an impatience with the deep things of Christian doctrine. That is, we want Christianity to be simple, easily assimilated, and not to generate any deep perplexities or difficulties. So then when we maybe get in a situation of being challenged in our faith by an unbeliever, we oftentimes don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. We can't engage in the art of apologetics or defending the Christian faith is true, rational, and engaging because we haven't spent the time reflecting on what it is and how it should be defended. So there's that kind of impatience with depth, intellectual depth, and an intolerance of abstraction or great doctrine. Think of the great doctrine of justification by faith alone. All you Lutherans, of course, hold that dear, as should any Christian. That is not merely a Lutheran doctrine. A lot of Christians today cannot articulate that doctrine clearly. They speak pretty vaguely about believing in Jesus or trusting in Jesus or believing that Jesus died for you. Now, that's all true. But you have to ask whether the Reformation had a point. And why did Martin Luther risk everything for this doctrine? What exactly is it? Where would you go to in Scripture to defend it? How does it differ from, let's say, Roman Catholic views of salvation or Eastern Orthodox views of salvation? So doctrine, of course, is highly significant. We're discussing truth about God that matters for eternity. But if we're worldly, if we're dumbed down, we don't really get into the Scripture. We have very little sense of theological history, intellectual history. We're pretty detached from our own tradition, and we can't articulate our own beliefs very clearly. I think that's very sad.
Before we go on to talk about that consumerist mentality, let's take a phone call from Steve, who's calling from Fenton with a question. Steve, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you very much, and hi, Dr. Grotheis.
Hello.
I have a real concern, and I've actually been doing a lot of investigating with a fellow by the name of John Eldridge, who's in the evangelical world, taking the world by storm with Wild at Heart and some of these other books. But I'm seeing he uses it in his seminars, but I'm seeing this in a lot in some worship services also, and that's this use of video clips integrated into someone's sermon, and it I have my concern is that by doing that, this media is so powerful that it goes straight through to the emotions and bypasses the mind. Mm-hmm. And I think it is an easy way to maybe to get some false teaching, or else, as you said, just to people lose the rational reason for their faith if they just utilize their emotions. I don't know if...
Steve, thank you very much. So, yes, the television, if it could be called that, has moved into the church with a jumbo screen. What mm-hmm. are your thoughts, Dr. Gordheis?
Well, I agree with what Steve said. I think that the use of video clips is potentially a very dangerous thing because you're focusing all the image on the popular medium and not really on the preached word. Now, if you're doing some kind of a seminar, possibly, and you want to illustrate something from popular culture and then you sufficiently debrief afterwards, that may be appropriate. I saw that done in a Death of Truth conference once several years ago. And I think it was fairly well done. But the problem is that these media, these visual media, are so transfixing, they're so bewitching, that it's hard to get people back. That is, people tend to go into a kind of passive entertainment mode once they sit down in front of a big screen and are greeted with a very sophisticated manipulation of images. So I'm worried about retrieving people from that world, from that sort of entertaining black hole, if you will.
That is essentially kind of the consumerist mentality, isn't it? The passive, I'm going to sit here and you need to give it to me in small bites that don't require any deep thinking, because after all, I'm simply the consumer.
Right. I think that good preaching, good teaching, for that matter, good music, makes some demands on the one experiencing them. Now, that's very anti-consumerist. That's very anti-pop culture. We want things to be easily assimilated. But you think of the gospel itself, what makes a greater demand upon us than to live our lives in radical dependency on the objective and alien work of Christ? What is more against the grain of our flesh and against the ways of the world and the devil than to utterly cast ourselves on the mercy of the crucified and resurrected Christ? I mean, that makes demands on us day by day, minute by minute. As Luther said, the Christian life is a life of repentance. So I'm a little bit of a stick in the mud here, I guess. I was once told by a radio announcer, so it's okay to be a stick in the mud. And I said, yes, as long as the stick is pointing towards Christ. There's sometimes when we have to go against the grain of a culture to go with the grain of the universe, if you will, or with the grain of God's kingdom.
Dr. Doug Gordheis, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues, Etc. Keep up the good work.
Well, thanks a lot. Have me on again sometime.
Dr. Doug Gordheis is director of the Philosophy of Religion program at Denver Seminary, author of several books, including his latest on Pascal and on Jesus. He's also written an article on the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled The Media Fast, Renewing Your Mind in a Worldly World. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Why did the real St. Nicholas give out gifts? Who was Nicholas? When and where did he live? And why does the real story of the real St. Nicholas tell us more about Christ than about Kris Kringle? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for December is the children's book, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. In this book, the real story of St. Nicholas is beautifully illustrated and simply told. You can order our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend by Julie Stiegelmeier.
Now, this Global Minute focuses prayer on a ministry in Africa that is helping a group of teenagers called Child Mothers focus on Christ's gift of love. In the African country of Uganda, there is a rebel army that kidnaps boys and girls and forces them into service. Some of the girls become concubines for the soldiers and give birth while in captivity. Other girls have escaped or have been set free with their children. A ministry called Action International Ministries is helping these child mothers by sharing Christ's love, but also by giving them packets which include gospel literature, soap, toothbrushes, tea, and other items. Action International Ministries is working in partnership with local churches when possible. Pray for these young mothers to grow in Christ and glorify Him. Learn more by visiting Action International's website at actionintl.org. That's actionintl.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The Medicare reform bill was passed last week, the biggest reform since that program began. Where I live in Illinois, it's estimated 100 doctors will leave their practices because of the high cost of malpractice insurance from outrageous lawsuits. Long, long ago, a man named Naaman had health problems. When the prophet Elisha told him to wash in the Jordan River, Naaman balked. This treatment, based on the prophet's word, made no sense. But his servants persuaded him, and Naaman was healed. 2 Kings 5. Trusting the promises of God as you face medical problems offers a hope that outshines any legislation or lawsuit. St. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. We groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling. I take one blood pressure pill each morning, only one. Last week I sat with my parents as they filled their pill boxes for the week. You know those 7-day containers with a letter standing for each day? I suggest we people of faith see the S at the end of the week and think of heaven. A Sabbath rest remains for the people of God.
AM 850 KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Monday, December 1st, 2003, Reconciliation Christian Bookstore. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in celebration of Reconciliation's 15th anniversary. Once again, a very special thank you to the folks at Reconciliation Christian Bookstore in St. Louis, today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsors.
Grande bisogno di questa pace il mondo. Penso in modo speciale, con profondo dolore, agli ultimi episodi si immedesima.
That was Pope John Paul II yesterday praying for those suffering from AIDS on the eve of World AIDS Day. That is today. We're going to talk about this issue with Robert Knight in just a minute. But first, we just finished our conversation with Doug Grodheis talking about the effect of the media on the mind. Television is a cyclops that eats books. Well, that is why we have an Issues Etc. Book of the Month every month of the year for you, our listeners. Not because we're simply interested in hawking books, but because part and parcel of what we do here on Issues Etc., talk radio for the thinking Christian, is provide good, solid books for our listeners, the kind of books that form the basis of many of our conversations here on this radio program. Now, you can start as early as you want. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December is actually a children's book, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend by Julie Stiegemeyer. She's a guest here on the program. The book is the story of the real St. Nicholas, the 4th century Turkish Christian who preached Christ and gave gifts, and the book answers a lot of the questions about the real story of St. Nicholas. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can find information on the book by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Information on our latest book of the month is there. It's called St. Nicholas. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House and order the book weekdays during regular business hours. Got 90 minutes to do so today. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. If you'd like to, you can visit one of the two locations that Concordia Publishing House has for bookstores. One is at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. That's Miami and Jefferson in St. Louis. Or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The book is called St. Nicholas. When you call or write or go in, make sure you mention Issues, etc. For the remainder of this hour, Robert Knight joins us. It's World AIDS Day, and we'll also be talking with him a little bit later about the issue of gay marriage, which is all the news today. Robert Knight is director of the Culture and Family Institute and affiliate of Concerned Women for America. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Robert, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Todd. How you doing?
Bob, tell us about World AIDS Day. What is this event intended to highlight for people who are observing it?
Well, I think it's supposed to remind people that AIDS is a tremendous tragedy for millions of people all over the world, not just in this country, but particularly in Africa. Overall, around the world, we have something like 40 million people afflicted with AIDS, and millions more every year contracting it. It truly is a plague. But I think the people who are staging World AIDS Day probably are doing it for the same reason anybody do it for the Heart Fund or the Lung Association or anything else. They want to call attention to their cause, and I think they want to raise more money for it. And alert people to the need for spending more on prevention and on treatment.
If we're really talking about 40 million victims of AIDS, and I imagine that just counts current victims in 2003, we are talking about a major health crisis in some countries, a devastating epidemic. How do we account for this?
Well, you account for it by human error because people are engaging in behaviors that spread AIDS. In the United States, the largest number of AIDS cases is still among homosexual men. We've had three straight years of increases in HIV infections reported by the Centers for Disease Control. There's been a 17% spike upwards among the gay male cases. And this is all in the middle of a multi-million dollar safe sex campaign. So that approach doesn't work. It hasn't worked in Africa, the hardest hit continent. People there are getting AIDS because of promiscuous sex, dirty needles, various types of sex acts that are more prone to transfer the AIDS virus more than others. A lot of the same conditions, actually, that you'll find in the homosexual areas in American cities, same kinds of conditions. And there's prostitution, all kinds of things. The bright spots are Uganda, in particular, which has cut its AIDS rate more than half by emphasizing abstinence and marriage and fidelity within marriage. That approach you don't hear about that often, but that's what's actually worked. They've convinced people that it's not worth it to have sex when you're a teenager before you're married, and it's not worth it to cheat on your spouse, and that's had tremendous positive results.
Now, in that connection, this weekend I was listening to the news, and I heard that a Vatican official was roundly criticized in Europe because he had pointed out that condoms and the whole safe sex campaign was not offering adequate protection to anyone from AIDS. And he said, look, chastity is a proven barrier between you and AIDS. Chastity is proven as a way of preventing it. He was roundly criticized.
Well, he was, because there's an agenda here, and it's more interested in preserving the sexual revolution and the gains of homosexual activism and radical feminism than it is in stopping a disease. It's that simple, because in the early days of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco, the gay activists even opposed screening for blood banks. They didn't care. And to this day, every so often you'll see that and blood donation program is under attack by homosexual activists for being discriminatory because they don't want gay males donating their blood because the incidence is so much higher in that group. But worldwide, we're seeing a push for homosexual affirmation, gay marriage in Western Europe in particular. Now we're seeing it in the United States and Massachusetts and various counterfeit forms such as California's Domestic Partners Program and Vermont's Civil Unions Program. But the whole thing adds up to this. It's that man is saying, we're smarter than God now. We can do anything we want sexually. The evidence is piling up that this hurts people, but we just don't care. We don't want to be constrained. We want to let it all go, and we're going to change public policy to reflect that.
We were told that the Safe Sex campaign was not only going to curb the spread of AIDS, but that if it was consistently practiced, AIDS could be brought under control. That seems to have failed. Where has it failed, Bob?
It's failed everywhere it's been tried. It's failed among teenagers. It's failed among tribes in Africa. It's failed among gay men in San Francisco. It just doesn't work because what you're saying is it's just a matter of mechanics. And you're leaving out morality. You're leaving out the fact that people can choose to change their behavior. That what they're pushing is risk reduction. Rather than risk avoidance or risk elimination. If you look at it another way, if you knew that jumping out of an airplane with a defective parachute would probably kill you, you wouldn't come up with a parachute that may or may not kill you. You'd be sure before you jumped out of that airplane. But what they're telling people is to go ahead and have sex, even with strangers, as long as you use a condom, because that might stop the AIDS virus and other STDs. Problem is, that people having sex with strangers tend to be inebriated. They're on drugs or alcohol. They don't use the condoms properly. The condoms break. And when you get two males together during certain acts, the condoms are utterly ineffective. There are also other STDs out there that aren't affected by condoms at all. And they're not telling people this, like human papillomavirus, HPV, which causes virtually all cases of cervical cancer that kills 5,000 women a year. They're telling our girls in high schools in America, you know, if you're going to have sex with your boyfriend, just wear a condom. That's safe sex. And then these girls are coming down with HPV, which is incurable. They're being lied to. And this has got to stop. The truth has to get out before there are more victims.
We're talking with Robert Knight, director of the Culture and Family Institute and affiliate of Concerned Women for America. He joins us from Washington, D.C. We're speaking first here about World AIDS Day, and a little later we'll talk about the gay marriage issue. Can we draw a direct connection between the epidemic of AIDS and homosexuality?
Well, we can in the United States because AIDS got its genesis among the homosexual population, and even the majority of cases are still in that segment of the population, even after two decades. There are reasons for this. First, if you have a population pool with a high degree of infections and you're in that pool, you're much more likely to get them than other people outside that pool. Second, the typically promiscuous behavior of homosexuals leads them to have more partners, and that opens them up to more risk. It breaks down the body's immune system when it's confronted with so many challenging illnesses. Third, the very type of behavior. Typically among homosexual males, they engage in anal sex. And I won't use that term again on the radio, but people need to know that the body was not made for that kind of punishment. And it's probably the most efficient way to transmit this disease. So you really do have it spread and centered among the homosexual population. The other group where it's growing is among minorities, certainly among minorities that practice homosexuality and spread it through prostitution and through drug use, needle exchange, where people are sharing AIDS-infected needles. That's the other fastest-growing area.
In the early 1990s, there was a heavy push on the Safe Sex campaign, and it seemed as though there was kind of a wake-up call, a bit of recalling to responsibility, a lull in the promiscuity, the bathhouse activity, the multiple partners among homosexuals and heterosexuals, for that matter. But then, late 1990s, it seems as though all heck broke loose again. And now we're right back where we were in the early 1980s when AIDS first came to everyone's attention.
Well, there's a good reason for that. It's called the drug cocktails. They developed these combinations of protease inhibitors, they're called, which hold off the worst symptoms of AIDS itself. and allow people to live far longer than they did in the early days of the epidemic. You typically live 10 years after getting the AIDS virus. Now people are living 15, 20 years and even beyond by taking many pills a day. And so the word is out in the homosexual areas that, hey, this isn't really a fatal disease after all, as long as you take your pills. And so there's an enormous amount of recklessness. And there's even a group of men who are seeking to get the AIDS virus. They're called bug chasers. There was an article in Rolling Stone magazine about this subculture in which young homosexual men didn't quite feel legitimate until they'd acquired the AIDS virus. So they actually staged parties with AIDS-infected men to get the AIDS virus. I mean, it's the perversity of this can't be underestimated, actually seeking to get a fatal disease so you fit in.
I was also listening to the same newscast this week, and I think this was on the BBC. They were talking to someone in Africa, where in one of the countries where AIDS is literally epidemic among homosexuals and heterosexuals. Mm-hmm. And they did not deny that the means of transmission was promiscuous sexual activity and intravenous drug use. They didn't deny any of that. What they were saying was, well, we found some people who were able to take these various protease inhibitors, and then they interviewed them, and they said, look, I've lived for 5 years, and I'm perfectly happy. I'm HIV positive. It doesn't seem to have affected my life at all.
No, except who's paying for all these drugs? The drugs do have side effects. That is entirely too cheerful an outlook for someone who's utterly dependent on taking very heavy-duty drugs for the rest of his life. And he's got a disease that, you know, will kill other people. Maybe they don't respond as well to this drug cocktail. That's the problem. There's an unrealistic assessment that AIDS isn't so bad anymore. And believe me, when you look at the statistics and the obituaries, especially in gay papers, and you see these young men, you know, we're talking 30s, 40s, early 50s, dying of AIDS and complications from AIDS. It's very real, and it's a tragedy unfolding.
Another phenomenon that I found curious, and again, it kind of coincides with this lull in activity and this recall to responsibility, but the victims of AIDS living, and especially those who died, took on almost a martyr-like status in the homosexual community. They gave their life for something that mattered. What is this about?
Well, this is about political activism. In a book called After the Ball, which is a gay battle manual for changing attitudes in the United States that was released in 1989 and has been followed almost to the letter about how to wage media war on religious folk who disagree with homosexuality and so forth, they actually said AIDS is our strength. We will use it to recast ourselves as victims. Americans will rush to protect us, and that will remove the stigma of homosexuals being the outcasts who actually threaten children and the stability of society. And they've done that. They've managed to use billions of dollars of AIDS funding and put it toward pro-homosexual programs in schools and in centers. It's just phenomenal. You think AIDS would be the slam dunk argument against homosexuality, but instead it has empowered the gay movement.
AIDS is also conspicuously absent from pop culture. And I mean that in the sense that homosexuality and its kind of favorable representation in all of the television programs, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and all the other ones, the sitcoms, Will and Grace and the like. AIDS may be occasionally dealt with in one tearjerker episode, but for the gay characters, it's not a reality.
Absolutely. They only have the positive side of gay life. The gays portrayed are just fun-loving, loyal friends, often the most steady heads in the crowd, the best people to be around. I mean, they make Sidney Poitier look like not a stereotype during the period in the 60s when Hollywood was trying to raise America's consciousness about race and have America overcome racism. They only had some black characters that were exemplary. And it's not that there aren't Sidney Poitiers out there, but if that's all you see, it's kind of misleading because people are more complex than that. Same thing is happening right now with homosexual characters. They're almost uniformly warm, witty, loyal, the kind of people you want to be around. Of course, there are people like that. There are homosexuals like that. But we're not getting a full picture of homosexual life, and we're not seeing any of the downside, the broken hearts, the diseases, the loneliness, the realization that, you know, you're doing something God doesn't like and God has warned you about, and therefore you're drowning it in alcohol and drugs, trying to push away that truth that in your heart you know is true. None of that gets portrayed. It's a full-court propaganda press on America.
If we couple the live and let live attitude now of the gay activist and the dropping age of sexual activity among our teens here today, what are we looking at in the next decade or two with regard to AIDS and the proliferation of other STDs?
Did you say if we drop our live and let live attitude?
No, if we link that with the dropping age of sexual activity among teens.
Oh, gosh, we're going to see a heck of an epidemic, because the AIDS epidemic of tomorrow, of 10 years from now, is happening right now. So that's another shocking thing. If you look at those AIDS statistics, if the highest number of AIDS patients, not HIV, but AIDS patients, is the, say, 18 to 24-year-old group, and you don't get AIDS for about 10 years, what does that tell you about when these kids got infected? These are boys who are preyed upon by older boys and men, and that's been a very real problem. There's a youth culture among homosexuals that's profoundly powerful. You see it in the publications and the novels and the magazines. It's just relentlessly toward boys. And the Catholic Church scandal showed that. The 85% or more of the victims of molestation in the Catholic Church by priests, especially in the Archdiocese of Boston, were young men, teenagers and young men, by homosexual priests. And the media tried to cover it up by saying, well, it was a pedophilia scandal, and pedophilia is different from homosexuality. And no, it's not, unless you're molesting a little girl. But if you're molesting a little boy, it's a homosexual problem. And this, it wasn't even little boys. It was the teenagers and the young men. The church is cleaning up its act. That's the good news. The Catholic Church in Rome has issued edicts that have been very good, supporting marriage and criticizing even civil unions, saying, you know, it's not God's way, and it just hurts people, and anyone who supports it, including politicians, including Catholic politicians, is not remaining true to the faith.
Some would say the answer is same-sex unions or gay marriage. Let's mainstream the gay lifestyle and give them all the benefits of monogamy, and we'll see. But this sounds a little bit like a redux of the safe-sex argument.
Yeah, it does. In fact, that's a very good point. Andrew Sullivan, the gay activist writer, has made that point that, hey, you people are complaining we're promiscuous and we're spreading AIDS. Why don't you let us marry? Well, Holland has done that. A couple of years ago, they instituted real gay marriage, and the journal AIDS just published an article showing that it didn't help at all. The AIDS epidemic is soaring among young homosexuals in Holland. Other articles have shown that among homosexual males, the monogamous relationships, so-called monogamous, all involve outside partners, and they are the most dangerous relationships to be in, because the participants try the most dangerous types of acts, perhaps out of boredom. So monogamy is not the answer for gay relationships. Getting help and overcoming the real problem, which is the sexual identity confusion, is the real solution. And, of course, the gay activists will tell the media, well, that's not realistic, we were born that way, without a shred of evidence. There's no scientifically credible study that shows there's a genetic link to homosexuality, and yet you'd think people were born that way just from the continuing flow of misleading articles.
More broadly, would we have 40 million cases of AIDS in 2003 without the sexual revolution that's been going on for 30-plus years in the Western world?
No, we wouldn't. You've laid the blame right where it should be, and that is the abandonment of the ideal of maintaining chastity before marriage and then fidelity within marriage. Once that standard was broken, and that began with a concentrated campaign after the Alfred Kinsey studies were released in the 1940s and early 50s, and Playboy magazine was launched in 1953, there's been a steady erosion of respect for sexual propriety. And part of that campaign was saying there is no real downside. There's, you know, you get a shot of penicillin if you get gonorrhea, but otherwise just have fun. The very tragic results of the sexual revolution are still unfolding, and it's hurt women and children most of all, except for the gay men who lost their lives early. But what amazes me to this day, Todd, is that after all this evidence has piled up that it's been a bad thing, there are still countless people defending it as a good thing. And I think that's because they have a personal stake in it. They have their own sexual problems, and rather than face them, they want to legitimate them somehow.
On this World AIDS Day, what should the real message, if the truth be told and the truth were known and everything was seen its proper perspective, what should the real message on World AIDS Day be?
Well, it ought to be one of compassion that a lot of our fellow citizens have become infected with a deadly virus, but the real message should be one of prevention and treatment instead of propaganda that it's everybody's fault and nobody's fault, that safe sex will solve it. The message of this World AIDS Day ought to be, we have reconsidered and we have decided that what has worked in Uganda so well, the return to abstinence, return to marriage as the emphasis, should be the worldwide message now.
And one final thought, if you would like to offer it, mm-hmm. on the whole prospect of gay marriage as its effect in this, finally, if it becomes a mainstream idea and institution?
Well, gay marriage is an oxymoron because marriage is the uniting of the two sexes, so there is no such thing. But if the idea of gay marriage becomes really gains currency in this culture, you'll just see more tragedy because kids will think, well, gee, there must be nothing wrong with homosexuality. So instead of steering my desires toward an opposite sex partner with the idea of marrying someday, I'll just go ahead and try out gay sex. One of the most prominent former homosexuals said that if gay marriage had been in place at the time he was struggling with his own sexual identity, he never would have gone through the trouble it took to come out the other side and overcome homosexuality.
Robert Knight, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Okay, well, thank you for having me on. God bless.
Bob Knight is director of the Culture and Family Institute, an affiliate of Concerned Women for America. He joined us from Washington, D.C. You can check out Concerned Women for America on the web, their site, cwfa.org, cwfa.org, or you can call them, area code 202-488-7000, 202-488-7000. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for an entire hour. That second hour is entirely for you. I have two things I would like you to consider, picking up on the issue we've just finished talking about with Bob Knight. All right, what are we going to do? Gay marriage is an issue. Should it be an issue for the presidential campaign? I'd also like to talk about gluttony when we come back off this holiday weekend. Stay with us for open lines right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.